to the News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this is The Friedman Report. The biggest stories of the past week were China, of course China, and the G7 meeting in Biarritz, France. And a lot of news was made this week. So let's start out the program talking about that. It's a big story. Welcome to News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this is The Friedman Report. Well, China made the news this week. The very first thing they did, not long after my last show, was to impose tariffs, new tariffs, on American goods destined for China. They imposed a tariff on $75 billion of U.S. goods in two rounds, the first on September 1st and the second on December 15th. In the first round, they targeted soybeans, fruit, and seafood with an additional 5% tariff. Soybeans is a big deal in the United States, particularly in the heartland, in the Midwest, where soybeans are one of the major crops and China is the major customer for America's soybean exports. So a further tariff on soybeans is a serious problem for Americans. The second round of tariffs that they plan to put on American goods would include coffee, autos, clothing, and TVs. And that would hit just before the Christmas buying season as an additional 10% tariff on these goods. So they were trying to hurt us as much as they possibly could. President Trump responded by adding more U.S. tariffs on $250 billion of Chinese imports, increasing the tariffs that he had already put on them from 25% to 30%, and an additional tariff on $300 billion in Chinese goods to be taxed at 15% instead of 10% starting on September 1st. In addition, he ordered American companies doing business in China to begin looking for other places to carry out their operations and moving out of China. He even encouraged them to come back to the United States. As the result of those two announcements, the stock market was hit hard. And in one day, the Dow Jones dropped 623 points, nearly 2.5%. It was temporary, but shocking nonetheless. And it signaled a new escalation in the developing Chinese-U.S. trade war. And then came the G7 meeting in Biarritz, France. And it changed everything. The first 2 days of the conference, Saturday and Sunday, produced some news reports because everyone was eager to find out what was going on. But the real news came on Monday. Several things. The first news report that came out Monday morning was that China had signaled that it wanted to resume trade talks. It was ready to come to the table, and it wanted to do it in a calm way. That was explosive. And then we actually heard the press conference that was given by French President Macron and United States President Donald Trump. They gave it together. And they showed an enormous amount of goodwill between them and in general on the subject matter that could have been very, very difficult, but turned out that there was a great deal of goodwill on both sides and they were able to find a lot of common ground. Macron said that there had been convergence on a range of ideas at unprecedented levels. Macron expressed a great deal of uncertainty regarding China. But he said that Trump showed a willingness to move forward, and he credited a great deal of the accomplishments of this week to Donald Trump. Trump said that any trade agreement with China must be balanced and fair for all parties concerned. He also said that there must be new international trade rules that will protect the parties to new trade agreements, and that the partners to the trade agreement are in compliance with it. There must be, he said, a respect for international property. He said right now the World Trade Organization rules don't protect us properly, and that has to change. He pointed out that China has the most to lose by not coming to the table and renegotiating the deals. He pointed out that China had already lost 3 million jobs as a result of the trade war, but that they stood to lose many more if they don't come to an agreement with the United States. He pointed out also that the U.S. has already collected $100 billion in tariffs as a result of the tariffs that the United States has already placed on China. But he also said good things about President Xi Jinping. He said he was a brilliant man and a good man. And he said that he wanted to come to the table, and in fact, he really had no choice because his economy was failing very rapidly. The media got very excited about this, and they declared that Trump was putting fire under the already increasing tensions between China and the United States. But I have to tell you, in my opinion, for whatever it's worth, I think he did the right thing. He's meeting fire with fire, and he is taking a hard line, which is going to put China in the position of having to reverse its direction in order to save the country, because the Chinese economy is suffering very badly. It's failing in many respects, and China has got to respond to it, or it will find itself in a huge depression from which it may have a great deal of difficulty coming out. So this is the situation as of this weekend going into the G7 talks. The news first thing out of the gate on Monday morning was that China had signaled its interest in coming to the table and negotiating in a calm setting. And if that is in fact what they said, it's a good idea. Because what happened in the past and what really accelerated this situation was that China and the United States went through a series of negotiations on what it would take to have a meaningful fair trade agreement. And by May 2019, they had hammered out what Trump and the other negotiators agreed was about 95% of the issues. That was a good thing. But then the Chinese negotiating team went back to China, and the senior officials in China took a look at the agreement and said, no, 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 we don't do that. No, no, no. What they were objecting to was the fact that America demanded, as they should have, accountability for all the things that China was agreeing to. China didn't like that. They didn't want to be accountable. They don't want to suggest that they will, for example, no longer steal American technology and then not be accountable for stealing it. They didn't want to agree to any terms that would hold their feet to the fire if they broke their agreement. So there we were, after having gone through all of the efforts of reaching nearly 100% of the agreement and almost ready to sign it, and China said, we don't agree to any of it, we are going to cancel everything we have done, and essentially, we don't have an agreement. That's where we were before the G7. And because Trump, as a result, slapped tariffs on them for canceling the agreement, this back and forth of Chinese tariffs, American tariffs, and so forth, had taken a very serious turn for the worse. And then, Monday morning, we heard this announcement that the Chinese were ready to come to the table. Good. Excellent. Great news. The Dow Jones went up 200, 300 points. That was great. But now we have to see what happens next. The reality is that China is in trouble. It's in trouble economically. Its economy is failing. It will be in greater trouble if American companies leave China. Millions of people will be out of work. Trillions of dollars will be lost. And then China is having difficulties in Hong Kong, difficulties to say the least. We will get on to that shortly. But China has got to face the fact that it is in trouble and it needs the support of a good, fair trade agreement with the United States that will reinstate Chinese economic activity with the rest of the world as well. So now we wait to see what happens next. But it looks promising. And as the G7 closes, that part of the discussion looks like there is unanimity among the members of the G7 about the way forward. Now, we have Hong Kong. And that's the other part of the China story. The situation in Hong Kong became much more serious over the weekend. It became violent. The Hong Kong police drew their firearms and pointed them at the demonstrators. They kicked them. We saw that. We saw that in the videos. They kicked them. They attacked them. And the demonstrators started fighting back. What had been a peaceful demonstration became violent. Demonstrators started throwing things at the police. And one policeman fired off one shot into the air. That needed to be understood as an escalation on the part of the Hong Kong police. China is in trouble in Hong Kong. The demonstrators have called for a general strike next Monday throughout Hong Kong. And depending on what China wants to do about this situation, that general strike could be a trigger for much more violence. And in the meantime, we don't know what China is going to do next. So this is a very precarious situation, and the Hong Kong financial markets are likely to suffer severely from what is going on now. There will be a flight of money from Hong Kong. That has already begun. A general strike means no business will be done. In such a vibrant free market economy, a general strike is a serious escalation of the demonstrations as well. So we will see what happens next in Hong Kong, but it bears watching and we will be covering it. You can count on it. Okay, let's get back to the G7 because there's more. Let's talk about Iran. There was a great deal of unanimity among the members of the G7. And by the way, I didn't tell you who the G7 are. So let me do that now. G7, a group of the largest advanced economies in the world, and they represent 58% of the global net wealth, and it amounts to something like $317 trillion. The group includes Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States. It used to include Russia, but when Russia invaded Crimea and took it over, they were dropped off this group. So what had been the G8 became the G7. The G7 countries also represent more than 46% of the global gross domestic product, GDP. So you can see that this gathering of seven industrialized nations is a very powerful group indeed. And now we have this subject of Iran, which came up big time during the G7 discussions. The group of seven nations agreed on three basic points relating to Iran. One, it must be guaranteed that Iran will never have nuclear weapons. Two, it will never have ballistic missiles. And any agreement that is decided upon by the members of the G7 with Iran will have a suitable time frame in which to contain Iran's nuclear ambitions and not the 10-year time frame in the JCPOA that was signed during the Obama administration, which was far too short. Now, these issues are important. The problem is it may already be too late. The information that I have is that Iran already has a nuclear bomb, a plutonium bomb, in fact, and that it already has ballistic missiles that can carry it. And the bomb has been miniaturized to the extent that it can be deployed. Now, I've talked many times and I've written a lot since the end of 2013 about how Iran and North Korea have worked together to develop three things: the development of a plutonium bomb, the miniaturization of that bomb to fit on a slender Shahab-type missile, and a delivery system that will enable North Korea and Iran to deploy that bomb. Now, the problem that we have today is this. Japan has already said that their intelligence indicates that North Korea has miniaturized a nuclear weapon that can fit on their missiles. And our own intelligence indicates that Iran similarly has miniaturized a plutonium bomb that will fit on their Shahab missile. Well, of course, they collaborated on the development of these nuclear weapons. We warned the world about that in 2013 and 14. We said that they were developing it, and it seems that they have already developed it. So we are talking about a much more serious situation in Iran and now in North Korea, where they have jointly developed the capability to deploy a nuclear weapon on a ballistic missile. And so if our intelligence and the Japanese intelligence are correct, two of the three points that the G7 agreed were necessary for a new agreement have already been met. So I think we have to go back to the drawing boards on this, but at least, well, their hearts are in the right place. There was a third issue that came up, and this is important because it may help to diffuse the situation. But before we get into that, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back, and we'll continue this discussion on the G7 and the Iranian threat. So stay right where you are. Don't go away. I'll be right back.
Hello, this is Lieutenant Randy Sutton, the host of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I am a 34-year police veteran. I am also the founder and CEO of an organization that stands behind injured and disabled law enforcement officers. It is called The Wounded Blue. Our website is thewoundedblue.org. We have produced a film. It is an important film. I urge you to watch it. The film details what happens when a police officer or law enforcement officer is shot or stabbed or beaten or disabled, seriously injured in the line of duty. Most people think they are taken care of medically and financially. The reality may be quite different. It is called The Wounded Blue: Service, Sacrifice, Betrayed. The film is available on Amazon, iTunes, and the Microsoft Store.
It's your news and entertainment network. News blogs, informative podcasts, entertaining videos, or listen to 24/7 talk radio on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We the people, AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Now, in the first part of the program, we talked about the G7 and how they dealt with particularly the problems with China and the problems with Iran. And by the way, at the end of the meeting, there were several deals that had been discussed to the point of being very, very positive outcomes. For example, the United States announced that it had made a deal with Japan. Donald Trump announced earlier on that he saw a great big deal with the United Kingdom after Boris Johnson had completed his Brexit, which was removal of the UK from the European Union. And of course, there was the news that a possibility of new negotiations with China were a real possibility. So those three things all by themselves. Oh, and then there was another deal with France, who had imposed a tax on technology that this would be removed. And so that's a lot of things came out of this meeting, which were very, very positive. And I think it's probably the most positive G7 meeting that has taken place in a very long time. So this was all good stuff. This was all good. However, when we get to Iran, the situation is different. Those were two really big issues. And I gave you my opinion on China. And we talked about what the possible solutions were and what we needed to do. With China, we need China to come to the table with the United States and solve the problems that they refused to solve first time around. That's doable, and hopefully they will do it. Then we also talked about Iran, and we started to talk about the possibility that Iran's President Rouhani may actually come to a meeting with President Donald Trump. Is it doable? It probably is doable if Rouhani is of a mind and the mullahs say it's okay for him to go. Because remember that he reports to the mullahs, who are really in charge of the country. And so we'll have to wait and see on that. But now I'd like to talk a little bit about what their solution was to the problem of Iran. And is it really viable? And I'm not sure it is. So let's get to that. And France's president announced that he had taken the initiative to put his foreign minister and the foreign minister of Iran together to negotiate the possibility of a meeting between Donald Trump and Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani. If that happens, there is a possibility and a hope that something can be worked out that could defuse the tensions in the Middle East. I have my doubts, but I think it's certainly worth a try. According to Macron, the possibility exists, and the foreign minister was marginally optimistic that this could be arranged, although maybe not right away. We'll see. Our feeling has been for a long time that Iran has a different agenda and is willing to create a great deal of chaos in the world before they come to any table to negotiate a settlement, if they are willing to do that at all. We'll wait and see. But in any case, what we did see at the G7 was all of these seven countries coming together amicably, which has not been the case in the past. They came together amicably. They seemed to enjoy the discussion and to agree on a lot of points that might have been controversial but turned out to be things that they could agree on. And so that bodes very, very well. I like what Macron said at the end. He said that he and President Trump shared goals. They had some disagreements on methods, but he promised that he would be at the next G7 meeting to be there at your side, he said to President Trump, with the same will and determination and the same desire to achieve unity. So this was undoubtedly a very good meeting. Now, before we got into generalities, we were on the subject of Iran. And I'd like to spend a few minutes talking to you about Iran. It's very important, actually. It's an important subject. And it's something we don't know very much about. You know, we've talked about Iran vis-a-vis the G7 talks. But I'd like to go a little bit further with Iran, because just as we talked about China being in a pretty bad situation, Iran is also. But their approach is very different from China's. They're as repressive, if not more repressive, than China. People are hungry. The people are impoverished because the price of things keeps going up and up and up. Even the army, I am told, is getting restless because they are not getting paid. Although the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which reports directly to the Ayatollah in Iran, they're getting paid well and they're fed well as well, because they are the elite. And they are really the ones with their fingers on the trigger. Now, Iran has been diverting whatever capital it can get its hands on to things other than supporting its population. For example, as I said, the government has been depriving the people rather than supporting them. They've been diverting their funds to support terrorist activities, for example, Hezbollah, Hamas, and so forth. Iran's official inflation rate for the last 12 months, ending in May, was 34.2%. That's huge. Now, that also means that the pressure that President Trump is putting on Iran through its sanctions, that's working. So that's a good thing, but it's not good for the Iranian people, because when the Iranian government diverts money to support the terrorist activities of Hamas and Hezbollah and others, that money does not go into the economy. And so when the prices of food and other necessary items skyrocket, the people of Iran find that they do not have the resources to feed their families and to buy the things that are necessary in order to live. The average Iranian household, as of May, were paying an average of 52% more than for the same month a year ago in 2018 for the same basket of food and services. The Iranian economy shrank by nearly 4% last year, and it sparked consumer riots in a number of cities. It is very possible that inflation this year could top 40%. That's huge. And that's on top of the 52% that it went up last year. American inflation, where it exists at all, is in single digits. So that's the situation in Iran. And yet Iran continues to spend its money on other things. So there is a great deal of unrest in Iran. And I believe it's incumbent upon our president to support that unrest in any way he can. In 2009, the Green Movement challenged the Iranian government with massive demonstrations in the streets of Iran. They failed. And part of the reason they failed, although the revolution went nationwide, part of the reason they failed was because the United States did not support them. Under President Obama, the Green Movement was ignored, and Iranian patriots who were demonstrating against the government died in the streets, and America did not lift a finger to help them. That cannot be the situation again in 2019. We're better than that. We are a country based on the ideals of freedom. The Iranian people are anything but free. They are oppressed. In some cases, they are starving. And their government does nothing to help them. Their government is obsessed with power, with the development of nuclear power, power to destroy, not power to build. And the Iranian people are their victims. So the question is, why is Iran devoting its attention to things like putting limpet mines on the sides of tankers and taking American drones out of the sky and generally creating mischief? Are they looking to create chaos? Are they trying to disrupt the world order? What is their end game? Well, this is a subject for another day, and we will talk about it, just as we have in the past. But we need to wait and see how this potential meeting between President Donald Trump and Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, we'll see how that works out. Will it happen? I have my doubts, but it's worth a try. And then if it happens, will there be any positive outcome from it? We don't know that either. There are a lot of things going on in Iran. They're spending their money on the support of terrorism, and also on the development of their nuclear program. Don't think for a minute that that has stopped. It is done in secret, but it is being done. And it is serious. And it is very, very possible that they will try to deploy it at some point. Just the other day, they deployed a host of armed drones from Syria into northern Israel. The idea was that some of these drones would hit Israeli targets. As it happened, none of them did, which is a good thing. But Iran is still up to mischief in spite of all the wishful thinking of members of the G7. We'll see. Stay tuned. Now, let's change the subject dramatically. I'm tired of talking about these crazy women and the squad. I'd rather talk about something else, frankly, but you know what? These women are so crazy that you can't stop talking about them because they're demanding attention and they're commanding headlines. And since we are reporting news here and analyzing it, I'm afraid I'm going to have to talk about them. So there are a couple of stories about AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She's a character and a half. And in my view, she's more dangerous than funny. But she's done a couple of things that are hysterical this past week. They're also dangerous, but they're funny. Dangerous and funny. Hard, it's a strange combination. But here we are. Okay, so what did she do? Well, the first thing she did was she decided, you're ready, of course you've heard this, of course, so it's not something new, but it's still what it is. She decided that our Electoral College was racist. And the reason she says that it's racist is because it allows the states with smaller populations to nevertheless have a voice in national elections. And because the greatest number of people of color in the United States live in the larger cities, and because they are on the East Coast and the West Coast, and also in places like Chicago and Texas and California, because of that, she has the idea that the states that have smaller populations of people of color, like Iowa, Nebraska, and maybe Wisconsin, these states shouldn't have the weight of the population because their states are whiter, really. Now, clearly, this woman, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, never took civics in high school. Or if she did, they didn't teach her anything. Maybe she slept through that class. And she never learned the purpose of the Founding Fathers for creating the Electoral College and not depending on the popular vote for electing a president. It was a reason. It was a good reason. When the Founding Fathers were making these decisions, there were states like New York and Pennsylvania and Virginia that had fair-sized populations. But there were also smaller states like Rhode Island and the northern states like Maine and New Hampshire. And these states had smaller populations. And the Founding Fathers knew that if they were going to come to some sort of agreement, they had to give these states with smaller populations a voice in choosing the president of the United States. The people who were the farmers, for example, they had to give these people a voice in choosing the president as well. And so they came up with the formula for the Electoral College that gave every American a voice in choosing the president of the United States. And it didn't matter what religion they were or what country they originally came from. What mattered was that now they were all Americans and they all needed to have a voice in the selection of their president. Now, come back to the 21st century and watch Ocasio-Cortez driving through the desert and saying, "This is the Electoral College. See how many votes we can get here?" Well, she was being stupid because clearly when you're driving through the desert, there are no votes out there. But she missed the point entirely. In order to have an equitable election where every American has a voice in the selection of the president, an electoral college is necessary. And a popular vote is not only unfair, it becomes oppressive because even though Ocasio-Cortez believes that people of color do not have the same voice, she's actually wrong. And I'll tell you why. Because the votes of the Electoral College are proportional. States with very large populations have more electoral votes than states with small populations. So, for example, California has 55 electoral votes, and Iowa has 6. Maine has 4, but Michigan has 16, New York has 29, Pennsylvania has 20, Texas has 38, then Vermont has only 3, and so forth. So, Ocasio-Cortez, do your homework. Stop being stupid and driving through the desert and saying, look at all these votes out here. No, the prairie dogs don't have votes. But if you were driving around in, let's say, Texas, your state would have 38 votes. But if you were driving in the desert in Arizona, you would have only 11. So grow up and do your homework and stop bothering us with your silliness. Oh, speaking of silliness, she's not finished. She went to the aquarium somewhere and saw a penguin in a tank and did a little dance running back and forth playing with the penguin. She looked like a 5-year-old, not a member of Congress. It would have been funny had it been a 5-year-old. See for yourself. Do a search for AOC, penguin, and see what you think. On that note, I'm going to take another short break. But then I'll be right back, and we're going to talk about the Islamists in Congress and what it means for the future of America. And that's a big story. I don't think it's covered enough, because this is an issue that we need to truly pay attention to. Don't go away. I'll be right back.
The question I always get asked is, where do I get the energy from? Well, keeping up with Malcolm Out Loud is no easy task, friends, even for Malcolm. Well, you may know that I've personally been taking Healthy Cell for some time now. Well, the great news is Healthy Cell has a new type of natural supplement called the Nutrition Gel. So no more hard-to-swallow pills. The good-tasting gel can be mixed into smoothies, yogurt, or water. These gels provide maximum absorption of essential nutrients, and it's healthy for our gut. Not abrasive like pills can be. You know, it's time for all of us to go pill-free. And you can try it with a free 2-day supply. Just cover $2.95 shipping, and the company, Healthy Cell, will cover the cost of the product. Go to healthycell.com/outloud, or simply click the Healthy Cell logo at the top of AmericaOutloud.com.
When Keith Ellison became the first Muslim to enter Congress as a congressman, we all wondered how that was going to work out. His very first act, even before becoming a congressman, was to take his oath on the Quran. As it happened, it was a Quran that had belonged to Thomas Jefferson. The book was Jefferson's personal copy of George Sale's 1734 translation of the Quran. It was in English, and it now resides in the Library of Congress. Jefferson owned the Quran not because he was a Muslim, he was not, and not because Jefferson was even sympathetic to Islam. He wasn't. In fact, Muslims were his sworn enemy, as he was called upon to fight the Barbary pirates who were terrorizing the ships that sailed along the Mediterranean north of what is now Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, and Morocco, but was then called the Barbary Coast. The Barbary pirates were Muslims who preyed on the merchant ships that sailed in the Mediterranean. Over the 250 years that they were active, they captured and enslaved more than 1 million Europeans, men, women, and children. And only those who converted to Islam were ever freed. But Jefferson owned a copy of the Quran. I believe it was in 2 volumes, and it was a very large book. But he owned it because he was intellectually very curious. And he wanted to know about everything that touched his life. So it seemed appropriate, maybe, for Ellison to take his oath with his hand on the Quran that had once belonged to Thomas Jefferson. It would have been inappropriate for him to take his oath on the Christian Bible. So that's where it began, Muslims in Congress. And on the whole, there should be no objection to having Muslim Americans as congressmen and women, unless they bring, and this is true of everybody, by the way, if they bring their hate into Congress and they spew their hate from their seats in Congress, which Ellison never did, as far as I know, then we're talking about a different situation entirely. Which brings me to the subject of two Muslim women who are now in Congress and have made a career so far, a congressional career, of spewing anti-Semitic hate from their seats in Congress. That's another story entirely, and that's what I want to talk about, because there's more to the story than meets the eye. For those of you who don't know, I have written a book called Hamas, Care, and the Muslim Brotherhood, The Plot to Destroy America. If this is of interest to you, check it out on the America Out Loud website in the bookstore. And you can order it through Amazon, or you can order it directly from me by writing to me at Ilana@AmericaOutloud.com. But I'm not here to sell books. I'm here to talk to you about the threat that radical Islamists like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, who are radical and are prepared to spread Islam throughout the country and through their position of power in Congress. Now, today, for the last part of this program, I would like to tell you about one of these two women, Ilhan Omar. And I would like to explain to you why I think she has destroyed her own credibility as a congresswoman because of what she has said and what she has done, and why I think she is dangerous, although she was duly elected, and therefore she certainly has a place. This is a quote from Ilhan Omar from a speech she gave last year to a CARE conference in Los Angeles. That's CARE, the Council for American-Islamic Relations. And this is what she said. She was explaining her mission to the people in the audience who were Muslims, like herself. And she said, "We have a mission as humans to love one another." Well, that's pretty straightforward. And if we could take it on face value, that would be a wonderful sentiment. But she was talking to Muslims. And within the context of her remarks, it was very clear that she was talking about Muslims loving each other. Then she said something else, and this shocked a good part of the nation because it was reported and many people found it extremely offensive. She said, "Here's the truth. CARE was founded after 9/11 because they recognized that some people did something and that all of us were starting to lose access to our civil liberties," unquote. Now, she was clearly talking about 9/11 and the attack by Islamist terrorists using commercial airplanes as weapons on the Twin Towers in New York, on the Pentagon in Washington, and on an undefined target, also in Washington, that ended up in a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Nearly 3,000 people died that day. They were murdered. And she called it, "Some people did something." She was also talking about the fact that after 9/11, Muslims were frequently targeted on the street, particularly those who were clearly identified as Muslims. And that was true. And it was wrong. But then she went on to say that she was tired of feeling like a second-class citizen, and that what she was promoting at this point was to raise hell and make people uncomfortable. That's what she said. The fact that a congresswoman could trivialize 9/11 in such a way is shocking on its face, and it speaks to the deep disdain that she has for this country, for the people who founded it, for the 3,000 people who died on 9/11, and for other Americans who don't happen to be people of color and who don't happen to be Muslims. So let's consider for a minute not just the words, but the organization to whom Ilhan Omar was speaking. CARE promotes itself as a civil rights organization. It calls itself the NAACP for Muslims. It's not. To be fair, it does some work on behalf of Muslims who find themselves in difficulties of one kind or another, often legal difficulties. And a part of the work that CARE does is on their behalf, to be fair. But the history of CARE tells a story that's quite different from the public service organization that it claims to be. For one thing, Ilhan Omar was wrong. CARE was not founded after 9/11, in fact. It was founded in June 1994, long before 9/11. And it was founded by a group of Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas leaders in the United States, including Nihad Awad, who is now, and has been since its inception, the executive director of CARE. Now, I can tell you the story of how it was founded, and maybe that's a subject for another day. But the important thing to know is that the founding of CARE and the management of CARE is carried out by people who are directly associated with Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood in America. And in fact, during the very high-profile trial of the Holy Land Foundation in Texas. The Holy Land Foundation was a not-for-profit organization that was dedicated to fundraising and managed in its short career to raise $12 million, which it transferred through a process of money laundering and sent to Hamas, a terrorist organization that was dedicated to the goal of destroying the State of Israel and creating an Islamist state of Palestine. This was the function of the Holy Land Foundation, trying, it said, to raise money for orphans and widows in what they called Palestine, but actually sending the money directly to Hamas. So in 2007, as part of the outcome of that trial, the federal government designated CARE an unindicted co-conspirator in the prosecution of the Holy Land Foundation for money laundering, charitable donations, and sending them directly to Hamas in Gaza. Now, there have been efforts to name CARE as a terrorist organization in this country. That hasn't happened. But in the United Arab Emirates in 2014, CARE joined the list with Al-Qaeda and ISIS and others as a terrorist organization. The whole background of CARE is suspect, and their operations are suspect, and their role in the network of Muslim Brotherhood in America groups, and there are hundreds of them around the United States. And these groups form a network that enable the Muslim community to have a far louder voice in American policies than their numbers in the population would suggest. Many of the members and participants in CARE's activity have been associated with terrorism. Hassan Al-Ashi, for example, who was a founding board member of CARE's Texas chapter, he was sentenced to 65 years for his part in the Holy Land Foundation money laundering scheme. CARE's civil rights director, Dr. Randall Todd Royer, trained with Lashkar-e-Taiba, which was associated with Al-Qaeda. And he was convicted of conspiring to engage in terror activities. He also was involved in training Muslim children in CARE's summer camps. using paintball guns in mock simulation battles. And it was people like this, associated with and actually participating in the management of CARE, who were revealed as part of a much more nefarious network of anti-American, terrorist-supporting activities. CARE's daily newsletters that come through email are full of information about the legal challenges that they are presenting around the country on behalf of Muslims every day. They practice what we call lawfare jihad by using American law to stifle criticism of any kind of Islam or of Muslims. And they use the word Islamophobia freely in order to attack anybody that they feel is anti-Muslim, whether they are anti-Sharia, which is Muslim religious law, or against building a mosque in a residential area. And they support and initiate lawsuits in order to teach courses in public school that present Islam as a favored religion, which is happening a lot around the country, by the way. So this is just a snapshot, a tiny snapshot, of the organization to whom Ilhan Omar was speaking and which she supports. And when she was criticized for her remarks, she called it dangerous incitement. In other words, criticism of her became dangerous incitement. Not her own words. Not surprisingly, she was the victim. But the criticism of her was dangerous incitement. Now remember that Ilhan Omar is a congresswoman. She sits in Congress. She helps to make policy and tries to make law. And she has been accused, justifiably, of spouting anti-Semitic accusations from her seat in Congress. For example, she declared that Elliot Abrams, who is an American diplomat and a lawyer, who has served in foreign policy positions for Presidents Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush, who was giving testimony to her congressional committee, she accused him of being a liar. She said, why should I believe you? Why should I believe anything you say? And then when he answered no to one of her questions, she said, I'll take that as a yes. She was rude. She was offensive. And she was showing her antipathy toward this man, who was a Jew, and who had come willingly to testify to her committee. Ilhan Omar is a very nasty woman. She is the same woman who accused fellow congressmen of taking money from the lobbying group AIPAC, and she said, it's all about the Benjamins. She was saying that Jewish congressmen are taking money from AIPAC, which is a pro-Israel lobbying group, basically calling them corrupt, and criticizing them for what she called dual loyalty, not just to the United States, but also to Israel. She doesn't mention her own dual loyalty to the United States and to the place that she calls Palestine. You see, that's different. That is her double standard. She's not guilty of dual loyalty, but any American who supports Israel is. So who is Ilhan Omar? And why does she feel that she has the right to turn America on its tail and undo 240 years of American tradition? Ilhan Omar came to this country as a young girl. She was a refugee from Somalia, where she had little opportunity to grow because she was a woman. But here in America, she has had unlimited opportunity, and now, after only a few short years, she finds herself sitting in the halls of Congress in the United States of America, earning a salary of $174,000 a year, plus perks, an opportunity she never, ever would have had in Somalia. But she never shows the slightest bit of gratitude for her new home and the opportunities it has given her. She belittles it and the people who live here. Americans. She criticizes it, and she thinks she has a better way. She wants to change it. She wants to make it something other than the refuge that she came to and that may have saved her life. When I talk about the dangers of an Islamist in Congress, this is what I'm talking about. We will talk about this more over the weeks to come because it's becoming a greater and greater issue as anti-Semitism continues to raise its ugly head in America and particularly in the halls of Congress. But for today, we have run out of time. So I would like to thank you all for spending this hour with me. I hope you have a good week, and I look forward to being with you again next week. You've been listening to The News Magazine on the America Out Loud Network. I'm Alana Friedman, and this has been The Friedman Report.